Welcome to the Fargo Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Fargo on FX. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about season 4, episode 9, titled East/West. You probably don't say the slash. It's probably just East/West. Aaron, what'd you think of this episode?
Boy, I tell you what, the Fargo Talks Fargo podcast must have been eating their words because they've been predicting a Wizard of Oz homage all season. And then look at this. No one talked about wizards. There's no mention of Oz. Just really, that souffle just deflated right in front of their eyes, didn't it?
Sure.
I mean, this is a good episode of television. It'll be interesting to see what happens to the rest of the season of connected events, because this was, you know, we've been talking about, like, man, we haven't really gotten a Satchel and Rabbi Milligan for several weeks since the, you know, the shooting war actually started and Rabbi took off. You know, what's going on with them? And this is an almost entirely unconnected hour of action, with a little bit of a manhunt to begin and the climax of a manhunt to end, and the closing out of Rabbi Milligan's arc, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But from an art, you know, like, this felt for Noah Hawley, this felt very much like his of a piece of some of the dream like work that he did on Legion. It's very reminiscent to some of the more aesthetic Coen brothers films. It's got a lot of internal references to those, because not only is a tornado obviously one of the famous things that happens in Wizard of Oz, it also is the way a serious man closes out the film. There is just a lot going on here that I'm sure we're going to talk about in terms of symbolism. And it was a lot of fun to watch, but I don't know how it's actually going to roll back and inform, you know, aid our enjoyment of the main plot of Fargo this season, which I don't think is in that dire of need of fixing, but
no,
it is,
no.
You know, yeah, if the next two episodes don't close out the season in what's considered a satisfying way, I wonder if people aren't going to be thinking, you know, start using the word, the I word, indulgent. About this episode,
wasted time. They should have been doing more with the Giusto Gaetano stuff.
Yeah, like Gaetano
could have got another scene.
More
of
farts.
Guys. More
we
farts.
Could've, we could have used another fart, another epic fart. Like maybe as Rabbi Milligan gets sucked into, he just says his bowels let go.
I don't think anybody except me would be saying that.
what'd you think? I'm curious.
I was not like super drawn in by this episode. I think after like the second watch, it was a little bit better because I was looking for the allusions to, you know, obviously Wizard of Oz is all over this episode. It's a black and white episode that turns to color eventually. Like you said, there's a tornado.
After a tornado, yeah.
I mentioned briefly, like, there are some ideas that Wizard of Oz is some like political, like a socioeconomic allegory about like the switch from gold standard to, you know, paper money not attached to it, like that.
Wow.
Kind of thing. And I think that's in here, but it's one step removed. It's like this is more about race and division in general than it is like the specific monetary issue, right?
Damn, New World Order, Deep State had MGM back in their pockets in the late 30s. You heard it here first, folks.
Apparently,
that's
yeah.
That's a stunning indictment of the golden age of Hollywood.
No, it was farmers and factory workers and things like that. So
this is something along those lines. I got this from Alan Sepinwall's pretty good review of this week. You know, I think he's my favorite television reviewer.
Yeah.
And he pulled out this I think 2007 interview to do like where they were doing a career retrospective. It's like a 50-page manuscript of this interview if you go through it. And this the person interviewing them, Elvis Mitchell, was asking them about different inspiration for some of their more like bizarre scenes. And they were talking about the KKK OEO moment from "Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?"
Yeah.
And Joel Coen says, you know, we've talked about this, Ethan and I, that almost every movie we make is just an attempt to remake The Wizard of Oz.
Mm.
I thought that was a really that was a really cool insight about their career, and I'm not sure how facetious it was being. I was like, I feel like I got to rewatch all their movies, but like, I watched A Serious Man last night after watching this episode and before watching again, and I wonder if that doesn't actually track. Like, so to that extent, this is kind of like the homage rolls into itself, and like to the extent that Noah Hawley knows about this quote, and I'm certain he does. Mm-hmm. The idea of a season of Fargo all culminating in a not shot by shot, but broad gesture towards the Wizard of Oz, I think feels pretty mimetically satisfying, if in no other way.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're right. That's the thing. Like, I'm thinking, oh, you know, are the Coen brothers all Wizard of Oz movies? And I'm not qualified to judge that. Like, everything I know about The Wizard of Oz, I've read in other people's writings in the last week, literally. I'm not even actually sure, we were talking about this before the podcast, that I've seen The Wizard of Oz all the way through, like every scene. I remember the big scenes. I remember tornado scenes and
flying monkeys
and all like the big ones, like skipping down the Yellow Brick Road and the Emerald City. I remember all that stuff. But have I seen it all the way through? Maybe. Have I pondered its meaning culturally and politically? Hell no. So and you know, there are Bibles that have been written about this movie, and I'm sure Noah Hawley has in film school studied this film, Wizard of Oz. So if he's doing things here, he's certainly doing things here that I'm gonna miss when I just do my cursory reading of it. So, and you know, watching this, I wasn't like super drawn in by the episode. I think it's a very slow episode, first of all. It's a lot of talking, a lot of like strange setups of scenes, a lot of like this ethereal feeling of something happening here, and you're not quite sure. It's like a dream world almost. And so it's hard to like go in there and pick apart like what are the interesting parts in here that I should be paying attention to, and what is just sort of window dressing.
Yeah, no, and that, you know, to the extent that I doubt we ever see Satchel, you know, in like something that's going to actually direct. Like, I don't think Satchel's going to come back to Loy and like talk, you know, do a 15-minute soliloquy about what he's learned on his way. To the extent that Rabbi Milligan's dead, and I kind of hope he is, not because I wished his character any ill will, but like, whoo boy.
In fact, I don't think we're going to see Satchel again. I think Satchel's done.
I think Mike Milligan, you're right.
And he's going to wander the land or whatever.
He's going to walk the land, and we know like where there's little, like we can see the little blueprints of his personality sprinkled throughout this episode. That's all there. So like, that's the thing. Like, I don't know that this will inform, other than like the really broad conceptual notes about uncertainty.
Sure. And change. And division.
Right.
Like, yeah.
Right. Uncertainty. And like, you know, there's a lot of interesting parallels in that. Like, the one time Rabbi Milligan does not tell Satchel that, look, if I'm gone, I'm either dead or in prison. And in fact, tells the counter lady, tell Satchel I'll be right back. Yeah. That's the time he winds up dead in prison.
Which I noticed on my first watch, and I'm like, oh, I'm so clever. I'm so fucking clever. I picked this up. And then I go and I start reading, and literally every single person on the internet and abroad in our email inbox, on the forums, on Twitter, everyone has picked this up. I'm like, okay, well, I got what everyone got. Congratulations, me.
Well spotted, because, you know, it's still nice to pick out the be like Cap every once in a while. I got that reference. But yeah, I think a lot of that stuff is cool and it works, and it's like, we might take it back into the main plot of Fargo, like these laws of unintended consequences, which I'm pretty sure is another Fargo title. I think it might be interesting, but yeah, I do wonder, you know, we got 2 hours left to close this thing out, and with FX, who knows, we might have 2.5 hours left to close this thing out. It is wild to like, I guess you needed to, though, like, you know, Rabbi Milligan and Satchel had this very important relationship, and, you know, obviously they're building Satchel into being the future Mike Milligan. So they needed to do justice by those characters. Mm-hmm. And this is certainly that, like, if you just, you know, like, what an exit for these two characters, if this is indeed their exit. But I do wonder, like, yeah, 2 weeks left. There's a lot. I mean, you know, like, It's weird because I feel like this is the Nega season two universe or the Bizarro, because like at this stage the Bald Move podcasters, you and me, had turned against Fargo season two, and everybody else was just all the more in love with it. And I feel like it's weird because broadly speaking, Fargo TV, the biggest subreddit for Fargo, I feel like on whole has started to turn on the season, or dismissing it as the weakest of all Fargo seasons. You know, as I'm still kind of engripped and engaged with it. But I do acknowledge that, like, with 2 weeks left, there is a lot of stakes as far as reputation, as far as does FX, are they want to continue to invest in Noah Hawley Fargo? Like, there's a lot at stake here, I think.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't the biggest show in the world. The sentiment I've been seeing over the last few weeks is that this is one of the weakest seasons, if not the weakest, with season three being, you know, the other one that's talked about as being pretty weak. And then this week,
my favorite.
This week, I thought everything changed. I thought people were really, really into this episode, far more than I was. But maybe I'm misreading the crowd. I don't know. It could be selection bias, right? Like, everybody who wasn't into this season has already left. And so now the only people left to comment about it are the ones who are super positive on it. And so that naturally you're going to get that upswing of opinion.
Yeah, it's tough. And it's like, you know, if I'm going kind of like by a triangulation of like what people are saying on our forums versus what people are saying to feedback versus what people are saying on the Fargo Reddit versus like Alan Suppenwall's comment section, which is probably curated to be kind of negative, because I think Alan has kind of been like, this is an all right season of Fargo, but it's really not a Fargo far. And he's been somewhat cool in his praise. So that could be. But I thought that like most every thread on Fargo TV seems like there is like beneath the two highest upvoted comments, there's a good strong middle current of but this still is not a great, and why isn't it great, and oh, people are just saying that because it's got black people, versus oh, I'm so sick of hearing about, you know, what passes for discourse. But
sure,
yeah, it will be interesting to see when it comes down to people's final memories. You know, I know Fargo gets a lot of help from it usually makes a lot of noise in award season, so it gets that kind of like, you know, FX likes that clout. But there's a lot, there's a lot on the line in the next 2 weeks, what I'm saying.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the Premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well. Lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun fan favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
Well, let's get into talking about the episode proper then, Jim. We start on a scene of post-tornadic carnage. Mm-hmm. Buildings torn apart, debris strewn about, and we come across the tattered pages and dismembered pages of the history of true crime in the Midwest. Do you remember this book and the role it played in season two?
I didn't, but I read up about it. Sure.
Well, what do you know? What do you know about it?
So in season two, episode 9, titled "The Castle," this is sort of the framing device used for the massacre at Sioux Falls. It's kind of how the episode opens. There's a storybook and the page is open, and it's similar to this, except the book is intact. And then we go in and we, you know, explore that whole story.
Yeah. This one is the mystery of who shot Willie Booper. Before, maybe. Mm-hmm. And who is the gas station attendant that works at M and Henry's filling station.
Yeah.
Which M and Henry, Auntie M and Uncle Henry, are, of course, the aunt and uncle from The Wizard of Oz. But there's, like, if you freeze frame and read this is, like, a perplexing mystery because this man clearly got shot and there's gunshot assailants. Their bodies spread miles over the crime scene. And it's kind of the rhetorical question of, like, how did this happen? Now, I feel like there's a pretty weak mystery since obviously a tornado hit the place and destroyed the building and strewn the corpses miles around. Like, I don't understand how this is an actual mystery. Maybe it's a framing device within the framing device of, like, oh, we know exactly how it happened, but let's just tell this tale the most entertaining way possible. But
what was the weather technology like, the weather reporting and recording technology like?
Well, I mean,
the 1950s.
I guess they do set it because old Willie's saying, like, the radio is saying sunshine, but my bones is feeling rain.
But surely somebody would have recorded that there was a tornado in the area at the time, right?
Well, and but also the gas station was like destroyed. Like, even like tornadoes don't. They don't tiptoe. They're not bulls in china shops, you know, like carefully, deftly weaving through to China. They leave, you know, 100-meter wide swaths of destruction when they come down. So it's like, but I don't know. Yeah, maybe Kansas weather science just isn't up to solving this crime scene. It's an F5 finger of God. But this dissolves into Omar, the boxer with the detached retina or some kind of eye disorder from getting hit in the head too much.
I think it's Omi. Omi is his name.
Oh, it's
right?
Omi? Okay. Yeah. Inspecting just the plaque that remains of the boyhood home of the person who eventually discovered Pluto as a planet. Mm. I think that the thing you're supposed to get out of this, because otherwise it's kind of mystery, is that Pluto is no longer regarded as a planet. Mm-hmm. Which underlines the uncertainty of this episode, even in terms of scientific fact. Imagine that. So he also we find that Omi has taken one of, I don't know who this guy is, but I suspect he runs around with the fada crew. He's one of the cannon fadas.
Oh yeah,
he's got him shoved in a trunk, and yeah, he's periodically interrogating him for information about where Kalamita is off to. Following this lead to liberal Kansas, which is already a lead the Kalamita's following, and this is exactly how I feared it was going to go. That, you know, this guy stuck a bag full of money in a wall, and he ripped out a page in a phone book to remember it, and it's all going to just lead up neatly into these guys meeting each other, when and how and where they need to. I mean,
it's fine. I thought, like, I'm glad they filled that detail in, because it was really stupid when there was no real reason for him to have that in there. It's less stupid now that we know, oh, he had a bag of money hidden in the wall and he was just remembering where his money was.
And maybe I'm being an asshole, because I do think that Holly did quite a bit to, like, make this less of a accidental meet cute. And, like, you know what? This place is in the middle of nowhere. There's essentially one gas station on the way in and out. Any car that runs on petrol distillate has to go through and stop at this station so you can set a nice little ambush. And then you've already got two to three that need to meet there. And then the third, oh, you know what? It's Satchel's birthday. I appreciate the fact that it wasn't just like, okay, there's this one town and there's a 24-hour lead and we're all just going to meet in some spot. And I'm glad it's a little bit smarter than that. So Omi is talking to Willie, the gas station attendant, looking for an Italian skeletal looking man in a red coat. We know that's Calamita.
Of course.
Willie says there ain't much Italians. It's mostly farmers looking for Salvation Methodist versus consecrated Lutheran. Something I discovered in researching liberal Kansas again is that this is liberal Kansas claims to be the birthplace of Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz.
Okay.
They have a small museum to that effect. I can't believe that didn't come up in my earlier research, but that's apparently the case. They have a whole museum, so there's a lot of nice little satisfying ties into this. He wants to know if he can hang around and wait for Calamita, and the guy's like, well, yeah, if you essentially paint the gas station. And they do, and I guess Omi presses this Italian gangster into helping him, and this guy does just a really shitty job of it. Like, Omi's very careful and precise and doing a good job, and this guy is like all, and I wonder if they're making, like, there's like a sly statement between forced labor versus labor that's like, you know, got something in it for him, got skin in the game.
Maybe I was thinking more like I don't know. I was coming at it from the race angle where, like, this is some white guy who's getting by doing just the shittiest job. And then, you know, the guy who is actually paying attention to what he's doing happens to be black. And so, you know,
I don't know, because I haven't actually read a lot of scholarly research on this, but I've always assumed that a lot of the archetypes about certain minorities being like lazy or shifty or whatever is because, you know, if they're not working in fair conditions, like, you know, slavery or a chain gang, like the idea of a prisoner being lazy about pickaxing a rock in the pebble, like, what the fuck does that even mean?
Yeah.
Like, what is the reward for industriousness? Or if you're like, you're not working to build your own home or make your life better. You're just doing some kind of pointless task for somebody else. Like,
what's my motivation?
A lot of people might be described as lazy or prone to like trying to sabotage things or get out of work if they were working under those conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a turtle parable. This guy's like, don't get me wrong. I wouldn't mind seeing the colored folks get ahead. And this is essentially like a poor white person's retort to the idea of white privilege, right?
Sure. I didn't read it as that. I don't know why I thought he was telling him this story exactly. But it's basically a Dr. Seuss story. Do you know this one? Yertle the Turtle?
Yeah, somebody wrote in and let me know the Dr. Seuss connection.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, this episode seems to be a mishmash of those kinds of things, like The Wizard of Oz and Dr. Seuss, and maybe like even an Alice in Wonderland sort of thing. They've mentioned Goldilocks in previous episodes, so like they do a lot of that fairy tale / you know, fable type of stuff. And this is another one of those.
Yeah. I thought that he was trying to get at us, like, look, you and I have more in common than you think, because like you think that we're like one up on you culturally, but me, I'm the turtle at the bottom getting crushed by the fat cat turtles up above. And you know, that whole kind of thing, but they get interrupted by Calamita pulling up. And I guess this guy sees his shot. Like, this is a moment to escape, and he gets gunned down. Calamita, despite being 30 feet away, does not hear this gunshot. and we will catch up to this action at the end of the episode.
Yeah.
Because Rabbi and Satchel are riding into town. They're listening to a McCarthy broadcast during the height of the Red Scare, and he's saying that we're locked in an all-out battle versus godless communism and democratic Christianity, and he's got 205 names of people signed up in the Communist Party, and it's just a dire threat to American ideals. And they pull up to the Barton Arms boarding house. This is a reference to Miller's Creek, this is a reference to Miller's Crossing that's in turn referencing Barton Fink. So it's a reference to the hotel in Miller's Crossing, which is itself a reference to Barton from Barton Fink.
Okay, I've not seen Miller's Crossing.
It's good. It's real good. If you want to complete the year of the gangster that we've gone through, see that for another gangster film. And they go into this house, and there's this way of separating people between East and West. What do you think about this interaction with the bellhop?
I mean, I feel like this hotel or whatever it is, Barton Arms, is America in a nutshell, right? And the division here between East and West is supposed to be, you know, not just city folk versus, you know, rural folk, not just a race versus one race versus another, but also like the rich and the poor. And like, it's all the things that divide us in America. And this is the result. This is the absurd, silly result of how that goes, right? The thing, the mechanism, it's like the turtle parable, the Yertle the Turtle thing, where, you know, the upper classes, I guess, the king in that scenario, the king turtle, is using the poor, the average person for their own gain, and people are being crushed along the way. This divisiveness is the same thing. And maybe I'm seeing that because we have never, well not never, but we are going through a period of extreme divisiveness here in America, and that is very much on my mind day in and day out. Mm-hmm. So maybe I'm seeing things that aren't intended to be there, but damn, it feels like that's one of the biggest parts of this episode.
No, I think you hit on it. Even like Rabbi Milligan playing the role of a person who's like, I don't really care about any of this stuff. Well, we'll sort you into a side anyway.
Yeah.
Like, well, I don't even know what these things are. Is the one in California, we'll take you for that. Like, I'm not political. Oh, you're an Eisenhower then. So, right. Like, I thought that was funny that, like, a person who's kind of like a true neutral. And Rabbi Milligan is kind of like that personification of the melting pot. You know, mm-hmm. He's an Irish kid that was sort of in a weird way raised Jewish, that has adopted a black kid as his ward. And, you know, even then he's being pulled apart in his hotel.
Yeah.
They explain that these sisters have been locked in a battle between each other that's probably doing nothing but dividing and hurting their tenants. There's a white line running down the sides, dividing everything into neat, you know, this is like something out of a Looney Tunes.
Yeah.
There's a man with boils undergoing suction therapy, which is another reference to a serious man. So the rabbi says he's got to go see about some money, the get him and Satchel set up. Satchel's concerned with the creepy looking boil man next door. Rabbi says he's just a man and reminds him of his stabbing lessons. Got to go for the thigh, gut, and the chest.
Mm-hmm. Mantra was always stab, twist, and rip.
Stab, twist, and rip. Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. Which one's that from?
I don't know that it's actually from anything other than the first part, which is like when you stick the knife in, you twist it to open the wound more. There's some movie that like...
I thought there was a movie or a TV show where they said something about stab, rip, twist, and rip.
Maybe it might have been verbatim. I don't know.
But Rabbi Milligan reminds him that, hey, if I'm not back, I'm dead or in jail. They never talk about what actually Satchel's supposed to do. Because like
sit in that room and read.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. What is the plan of action in case of the dead or in jail? Because he's still stuck in Nevada's. Here, he's alone without any money. Like, you know,
yeah.
Thigh, gut, chest. That's all you got to remember.
No, that's a good question. I don't know.
Stab your way to victory. So Rabbi is here to visit the feed store, which we find out that he's hidden $5,000 in the walls of, and he is shocked to find out that there's two brothers, the Indiana brothers, mm-hmm. Beachwood and Haskell, have set up shop, knocked down his wall, and probably taken all of his money and turned it into a home goods store, appliances, furniture, that kind of thing.
This is the least interesting part of the episode, in my opinion. Like
I
don't know why this is really even in here other than he needs money and he's got it hidden. And it tells us that this is why he had the flyer in the Bible. Do you have anything interesting to say about
this?
There's no conflict
other than the central one without this scene and the next scene. Like literally nothing interesting would happen except for the end of the episode. And you can't do that. So I'm guessing that's why
I guess.
You got to have. You got to have a story circle in the middle of your story circle, I guess.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Satchel discovers a rattling and a thumping coming from the armoire, and it's shot like The Conjuring. You think some kind of ghost is going to spook out of here, but it's not. It's a rabbit. It's a little Toto-looking dog.
Yeah.
It's interesting it's called Rabbit because the way that shot when he gets out of the house and then leads him down a spiral staircase, it does seem like Alice descending into a rabbit, you know, down a long twisting rabbit hole.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, the dog scratches be let out, runs down the rabbit hole, and he encounters a man with a secret who's taking secret drinks. His name is Hunk Swindle. Hunk was one of the names of a farmhand that Dorothy was acquainted with over on Auntie M's farm. I think he was a scarecrow.
Okay.
Here, he's an aluminum siding man, which I think would put him on the side of the Tin Man, but I don't know.
I went through all the characters, or all the main characters in Wizard of Oz, and I was like, which ones line up with which? And I have no fucking idea. I spent maybe 30 minutes thinking about it.
I really don't think these characters line up one-to-one with anybody. And I guess this is where when I was pretty excited about the Fargo Speaks Fargo theory, because clearly there's a lot of build-up to Wizard of Oz. And, you know, we saw the next week on, it's like, oh, shit, it's a Wizard of Oz episode.
Yeah.
But I was still skeptical about, like, they were trying to break down and assign, like, well, Dorothy's Ethel Rita, and the Scarecrow is her dad, and the Tin Man is the guy with the... And I'm like... and all that stuff, the predictive elements of, like, you know, what this means and where it's going, and they're all going to have to meet the wizard, which is, of course, Loy Cannon, probably not going to get fulfilled. And that's one of the reasons, like, we've been doing this TV stuff about 10 years, and 99.9% of the time, these are how these big elaborate theories works out. Like, thematic tie-ins, like, and this goes back to the Leftovers, this goes back to previous Fargo seasons, this goes back to, you know, Westworld with Rehoboam and Solomon and all that biblical stuff. It never, almost ever pans out exactly the way, you know, the more literal you take the theory, the more off it ends up being in the episode.
For sure. And this episode has all the visual trappings of the Wizard of Oz, obviously. And I think it is doing something thematically. Maybe this is a good time to talk a little more in depth about the supposed, political, financial, gold standard message of the Wizard of Oz.
Do you want to? Sure.
I can only talk about it in broad terms because I don't, obviously I'm not a scholar.
Yeah.
But as I understand it, a lot of people think, and a specific author who's written about the Wizard of Oz years and years ago, and I don't remember his name, thinks that it was some message about when they were doing the switchover from the gold standard to something else, right? Everybody was talking about what should it be, and we got to get off this gold standard. It's not working.
Fiat currency, baby.
To the fiat currency. This movie, or this book, because it was originally a book, was written about that and all the political turmoil around it, with all the different characters being sort of representative of a segment of society. And the ones that I've got here is that Dorothy, which may in this case be Rabbi and or Satchel, maybe both of them, is kind of the average or I would say ideal American. It holds all of the traditional American values within that character. And all the things that, like, when you think of what America aspires to be, all the lofty ideas for America, that's Dorothy. And then the Scarecrow is supposed to represent farmers who at this time were very much against the idea of the gold standard because they were getting screwed by it, I guess. Really? And they were looking to decouple the money from the gold standard and move it to like a gold and silver standard. So each of those would have equivalent amounts of, currency tied to them.
They should have gone for the corn standard. So they'd held all the cobs.
You know, if you could grow your own money, that'd be perfect.
Yeah.
So that was a Scarecrow. And then the Tin Man, which maybe is supposed to be Billboard guy in this. I'm not sure. Are the factory workers, which there was a lot of unemployment in the late 19th century, I guess, in factory workers. And the Tin Man was supposed to be, it's in the name. They're, industrialization is happening. The Cowardly Lion, I guess, is supposed to be a very specific person who was a proponent of the gold standard. I can't remember his name, but
really,
yeah. Sorry, not a proponent of the gold standard, an opponent of the gold standard, or proponent for,
I see.
Of getting rid of it. The Wicked Witches and the Sisters who own the Barton Arms. I mean, I think this is a pretty obvious like connection here. The East and West Witches are sort of the financial and or political interest that were in power at the time. So East would be like Wall Street, and the West would be like industrialists, right? The railroad tycoons, the oil magnates. And you get a little bit of that with the oil guy in this, right? He wants to go out to Texas and strike it rich on oil. Bankers, stuff like that. And then the tornado is just representative of the political upheaval of the 19th century. And maybe in this, it's representative of the racial upheaval in the 20th, you know, where we're talking about the 50s, where race is mentioned in basically every episode of this season of Fargo, right?
Sure.
Plays a big role. And like I said, it has something to do with farmers wanting to the dollar to have both gold and silver standards. And I guess Emerald City...
So how does this actually... okay, the character, the dramatis personana seems like it checks out, but how does the action... Like, the Wicked Witch gets melted by the average American's bucket of water?
And that's the thing, right? Because, like, the witch that the house drops on... There's a shot in this episode where the gas station attendant's legs Willy's are sticking boots. Out. He's got the boots and the striped socks, just like the witch. Like, I don't know. I really don't know. It's a very confusing thing to me, not fully understanding The Wizard of Oz. But I guess the Emerald City was supposed to be Washington, D.C., and the wizard himself was supposed to be the president, who actually is revealed to not have as much power as you think. It's all... You know, the witches and that's why he asks Dorothy to go kill the witch for him. That sort of thing. I don't know what Toto is in The Wizard of Oz. Toto might just be a cute dog in The Wizard
Third
of Oz.
Third party voters.
There you go. Yeah. It's first past the post system. Yeah.
It's causing all the parties. You're getting the rich witches all riled up all the time. Yep.
So I don't know. That's the research I did and the connections I was able to tenuously make, but man, they're so vague, they're so borderline connected that I don't know where to put that stuff.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I really do think this is all more thematic and, you know, very, very sketch rather than concrete lines and you know, concrete parable. Because even like, you know, like O Brother, Where Art Thou is a, an odyssey, like a reference to that, right?
Is it
Odysseus? I believe so. Like, you know, it's got the Cyclops and it's got the sirens and all this stuff, but like, it's much more an homage than it is an actual like shot for shot remake. Or it's an absurdist comedy. You know, this isn't which I guess is a form of great literature. But there's not these like one to ones. But anyway. I did the same experiment. I was trying to like, oh, this guy in the cap, I bet, you know, oh, he just said he's aluminum guy, so he's the Tin Man. All right. This guy in the cap is wearing leather. Leather's an animal product. Maybe that's a lion. The Roanoke. Maybe he's the tall and thin. He's the scarecrow. But it just really doesn't. Then you meet the hero of Wounded Knee. He's got all these medals that kind of reminded me of post Delusions of Grandeur, Cowardly Lion, once he got his courage medal.
Yeah.
And it's like, but what does that even fucking mean? The Cowardly Lion's a pedo? Like what? It does kind of break down. Yeah. Like it defies a one-to-one analysis. I'm going to have to listen to Fargo Talks Fargo to see what they make of it. Cause you know, they're ground zero for the tornado itself hitting.
And this whole thing is in the backdrop of this hotel that's divided right down the middle. Right. And that's the lens through which I was trying to identify people. And so I come away thinking, okay, the salesman is like the politician, who he's a smooth talker. He's making friends. He's shaking hands, kissing babies. And he's trying to divide us. There's the aspiring oil tycoon who's like the industrialist, right? Who's trying to divide us so that they can make a buck off of us, rile us up. Yeah. And then there's the preacher, yeah, which religion is obviously pretty divisive. They do a lot of that too. But then you get to the old guy and the young girl, and I'm like, are perverts trying to divide us? Like, what's what's happening here? I don't know.
Maybe perverts are the things trying to unite us. It's the one thing we can agree on, God, I think, as society, is that child predation is bad.
It just starts from there, and
still polls well amongst Democrats and Republicans. I do think there's something interesting in that, like, if we want to abandon the Wizard of Oz bullshit for a minute, it's much easier to pick out the elements that make Mike Milligan Mike Milligan, like his gift of gab,
yeah,
you know, win friends and or
influence people,
gain, yeah, influence, and yeah, win friends and influence people. There's some of that. Mike Milligan's like economic concerns, always looking for the angle to get rich. You know, he gets it from his father Lloyd, but also this guy, this Texas wildcatter who wants to go strike it rich in oil. It's a lot easier to see all the different things he picks up to become Mike Milligan. Assuming, I think it's a safe assumption that you're supposed to understand this about Satchel at this point.
I think so.
So Rabbi gets back and explains that things are not as he left it. And as far as the situation, he reminds Satchel to not do any wandering, draw unwanted attention to himself. There's this weird scene where, like, I think this is probably rich in symbolism, but it got overshadowed with all my Wizard of Oz stuff. He takes his shoe off, shakes out a rock, looks through the hole. But there's, like, I don't know, the way the camera followed that rock, I felt like that was probably something. But I don't know what it is. Maybe some people can help us out with that at fargo@baldmove.com. Then the dinner bell rings. Satchel's been wanting to eat this whole episode. They go down, and there is this crazy scene. You got Hickory J. Milch is the wildcatter. You got Pastor Roanoke and his mother. You've got these two wicked witches going at each other with their ear horns. They can't hear what the other's saying, which is, you know, if you want to talk about modern politics and both sides not listening to each other.
Yeah.
You've got this major who's the hero of Wounded Knee, which Wounded Knee was a massacre of Indian civilians by the federal troops. So, like, that's all wrapped in irony, and he's clearly got – this is not his niece. This is some child bride that he has ensorcelled somehow. The Pastor Roanoke is himself a mystery wrapped in an enigma, because Roanoke, of course, is a story of this famous lost colony – that the only thing we know about him is them scribing the name of a Indian tribe that they might have gone off with. Like, this whole fucking dinner scene is just, I don't know. It's designed for film grad students to analyze and jerk it to, I believe. There's even a shot. The Holly takes a drive-by at the Prosperity Gospel when this one pastor tries to launch into a traditional giving thanks, and this guy takes over and says, you know what, we pray for success and risk equals opportunity. And the preacher himself says, that's some kind of cockamamie blessing. Mm-hmm. Does it all, you know, add up? I don't know. At some point, apropos of nothing, the major starts to tell his niece a story about Goldilocks, which causes Carnegie Man to jump in there and be like, I actually read that it used to be witches, not bears. This also ties back to Milligan's father talking about, in the first instance of the son swapping, like, you ever heard the story of Goldilocks? Well, yep. This kid's been in your bed, and he's been eating your porridge, and he's been wearing your clothes to goad him into killing him. And it's about an outsider in search for themselves, which, of course, is kind of like the Rabbi Milligan story. Like I said, it's all interesting stuff, and it connects. But, like, it's also, what is it going to tell us about the future of Fargo? Probably not much.
Well, the future is now, so it tells us everything we need to know about now.
I was going to talk about that Rabbi is also really upset about this sign giving him angst about his uncertain future. And he has this back and forth with this guy who seems like he's read a lot of philosophy books for a guy who just paints billboards for a living or pastes billboards.
Mm-hmm.
That then wraps into Rabbi coming back to stick up the Hoosier boys. And they're even talking to him in terms of being an enemy of change. and nothing really comes of that. He sticks him up and he gets like a small fraction of the $5,000 in return.
I think is it on the way here that he's listening to the radio and they talk about a shootout at the slaughterhouse? Is that when this happens?
I got the Joseph McCarthy stuff. I didn't get the slaughter in the feed house or whatever.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly when it happens. It's before he finds out that it's Satchel's birthday.
Is that talking about the Kansas City business then?
I think so, right? Yeah. We're going to come back and see that like either a lot of stuff has happened or we're going to flash back a little bit to see the stuff that happens.
Yeah. So Rabbi's got not a lot of money left, but it's a good chunk. I think this becomes completely irrelevant by the end of the episode, though. Meanwhile, an officer is hassling Satchel outside for no reason other than he's a black kid sitting in an automobile. Rabbi comes and interrupts the process, and the cop takes an affront. Is like, how'd you get stuck with this black kid? And he spins this tale about his buddy serving in the war, got shot by Germans on the first day of peace. How ironic. And the officer clearly now thinks that he's the asshole, but like petulantly offers this advice. Like, well, if you don't want this to happen, maybe you should keep this black kid hidden, which the rabbi thanks him for his fucking advice. And then Rabbi says, we got to get out of here because the things have changed. We got to leave right after the meal. Satchel says, well, can I bring Rabbit with him? Rabbi says, no, because he makes too much noise, draws too much attention to us. And Satchel is very depressed because he wanted just one thing of his own on his birthday. Do you think this is Satchel's actual birthday?
I assume so. I have no reason to think it's not.
It could also be a kid just trying to like get a win, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. Satchel doesn't seem like that kind of kid, but. Sure.
If it is, I agree. But if it is as it is, as they say that this is Satchel's birthday and metaphorically the day that Mike Milligan's born, that's kind of elegant.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they have the same, you know, fictitious and illustrative and literal birthdays.
Yeah, that's cute.
So this sends Rabbi Milligan into a tizzy because he doesn't, you know, he wants his kid to have a little bit of normalcy and he's not going to let him keep the dog. So he's like, where can I find a cupcake or a candy bar? The witches don't believe in sugar because they're witches. So the bellhop, that's not the name for this lady, the boarding house manager says,
sure.
Yeah, the boarding house manager, front desk lady says, you got to go to this filling station, the only one anywhere near, which is going to set him on the collision course with Kalamita and Omi. And that's exactly what he does. Milligan rolls up. Do you want to talk about the future is now scene?
Yeah, yeah.
What's your analysis on the final way that sits with the billboard guy?
This is where I kind of come down as the billboard guy might be the Tin Man, because he, you know, I talked about how in the late 19th century, there was a lot of unemployment in amongst the factory workers. And he, in this episode, does the very thing that puts him out of a job, right? He finishes this billboard and now he's out of a job. He's unemployed, as he points out, the irony of it. I don't know. He lays out so many possibilities here, right? What could this billboard be about? To me, it was part of that theme of change, like the idea that fools think things will stay the same. It seems like so many people fight against change, and that is what causes so much of the strife, in everyone's lives. Whereas if we just sort of embrace change and said, okay, how are we going to adapt? How are we going to figure out this future that is inevitably coming? We could avoid a lot of that. That was my take on it.
Yeah, and it's interesting also in the episode deliberately connects Mike Milligan to this agent of change. You know, someone that one of the Indiana boys says as much, like, oh, this guy's... you know, he's fighting change or whatnot. We know that he is the agent of change because he's the one that disrupted the child hostage situation, you know, upended that whole deal.
Season at large has been broadly about that, you know, like they set this up, they establish it in the first episode, the very first opening scenes, right? How the change has come through multiple generations. It was the Jewish people running it. Then it was the Irish. Then it was the Italians. Now it's going to be the Blacks. Like, it's that change is inevitably going to keep rolling. And you got to roll with it. Otherwise, you get eaten alive.
Yeah, and there's also an interesting irony in that now Rabbi Milligan has his certainty that he's not even happy with, because he doesn't like to find the futures. Now, what the fuck does that mean? And the billboard guy's like, well, yeah, now I've given you your certainty. You're not happy with it. And my future's uncertain.
Yeah.
Isn't that I thought that was kind of an interesting verbal play and concept. Mm-hmm. Milligan rolls up to the gas station, sees Willie's feet sticking out. They don't quite roll up and disappear. But you know what? It's in black and white. Maybe those things are ruby red. If you pulled them off and clicked your heels, you could have gotten out of here.
Could be.
Rabbi. But he pulls his gun. He sees Kalamita through the window sticking up Omi. Kalamita fires a couple shots at Rabbi when he notices it. Hits him in the shoulder. He staggers outside. Kalamita follows him. Omi struggles to his feet and plugs Kalamita one. But then he dies. He goes down hard. And the rabbi is struggling because he's shot in his gun arm. He's struggling to raise his pistol with both hands. It gets knocked out of his grasp by the tornado blowing a piece of driftwood into him. Sure, there's driftwood in the middle of Kansas. Why not?
Yeah, it's pieces of this shop, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah.
Fence posts? Sure.
It's flying wood, not driftwood. It's flying wood. Yeah. And Kalamita, at the last minute, sees the tornado, gets sucked up into it in pretty spectacular fashion, as does the rabbi. And in fact, I was starting to think, like, do I have a problem with the rabbi standing here in the middle of this debris field not getting pulled to bits? But then he got sucked up. I'm like, oh, okay, yeah. Well, if he's not going to live through it, we can have some moments of poetic. Well,
that's the thing, right? This whole scene can be summed up as everyone gets sucked into the tornado. Like, none of the bullets, none of the gunshots, none of the showdowns, none of it means anything because they all get sucked up into a tornado in the end. Which to me is like representative of those winds of change, right? The tornado is the change that's coming, and if you don't get out of the way of it, you're going to get sucked into it, and there's nothing you could do against it.
And from a purely Coen Brothers reference, like I said, this is literally the final scene of A Serious Man. A tornado approaching the town is going to destroy the school that his kid's at, probably kill his kid. It's a big, you know, a Serious Man is just a huge, never-ending, nested parable of Jewish mythology and Bible and Old Testament Bible stories. You got David and Bathsheba in there. You got the trials of Job, even down to three false comforters to go and give him advice and wisdom in the form of these rabbis. Like, there's a lot. There's a lot to unpack there. But also, yeah, big fat tornado at the end. Satchel awakens on the floor. You know, obviously, Rabbi Milligan hasn't come back for him. And now it's all in color, just like after the tornado and the Wizard of Oz. It's now in beautiful technicolor. The Boyle Man is quoting Revelation about the Alpha and the Omega, this early book of Revelation stuff. Says to come closer. Now, a lot of people pointed out that this is the exact same actor that plays Yiddles Milligan, which was the rabbi's dad.
Is it? Okay, I didn't recognize actor. Him.
Huh. I didn't either, but it's the same actor, and I don't know what that means. It is interesting that, like, Rabbi Milligan doesn't even seem to notice these guys. Like, there is kind of some kind of ghostly apparition quality to them. But again, I don't think, like, whatever theory you come up with, if it sounds good, it's probably going to be right, because I don't think this is something that can be falsified, you know? Like, I don't think Mike Milligan's were... I don't think that Satchel we're ever going to see from again, certainly not Rabbi Milligan. So what this does or does not say about his father and childhood and relationship and Satchel's formative, like, whatever sounds good, it's up to you to make it, because it's going to be choose your own adventure.
Yeah, I don't really. This is maybe the most confusing scene of all to me. I don't understand any of what's happening in this scene. But I did see some people mentioning also that this kid might be the same actor as the kid who he killed, who Rabbi killed.
Yeah, and I didn't have time, because someone also mentioned that the Roanoke pastor was one of the Jewish gangsters as well, which puts us all these scenes in like some kind of dream, like purgatory, bowling alley situation from season three of Fargo. And the one last fun thing for your theory crafting is Rabbi Milligan's dad, as he died, put a curse, a death curse on him, saying, you know, I'm putting a curse on you and all your children. I mean, probably. I mean, like, if you want to say, like getting sucked in tornado, that's some cursed shit right there. I don't know what this does with Rabbi or with Mike Milligan, you know, to the extent that he's his child, which I think it's pretty easy to see in these episodes. You know, is that how Mike Milligan exactly is cursed?
I don't know. But, either.
There's also like the preacher, the Roanoke guy, holds like they're folding up a flag, but appears to be the Betsy Ross flag, which is another kind of like adds a dreamlike quality, as well as the way they're dressed is very strange and kind of colonial, pre-colonial time. So Satchel is unnerved by this man wanting him to come closer to him. And he takes it back off to his room, goes to sleep with a gun, awakens, and finds that he's alone. Rabbi Milligan's not going to come back, and decides to head on up the road, sees the billboard that the future is now. What does it all mean? Did you do any look into this Mellon Mounds plaque that was by the Barton Arms?
The one that... Rabbi describes as just saying sleep with one eye open.
Yeah, it's this plaque is to the Mellon, this family called the Mellons, who lured in travelers and beat them to death with hammers and buried them in the back, which is a real life, or which is an analogy or an allusion to the real life Bender Mound. That's an actual cultural marker in Kansas. This is a family of serial killers from the late 1800s in Kansas. They set up an inn, lured travelers there, and then either beat them to death with hammers or cut their throats with knives before burying them in their apple orchard out back. So there's a lot of like weird details that go into this. I don't know that any of them connect in any way to the episode. I know that that's the illusion, that's a connection. Again, maybe it's uncertainty. You know, as a traveler, you find a port in a storm, and then they turn around and kill you, violate your guest right, all kinds of stuff. But
yeah,
that's the episode.
Sure it is.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is reward unto itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
You can send in your takes to fargo@baldmove.com. There's also a Fargo thread on our forums at forums.baldmove.com. And a lot of people took us up. We got a lot of great feedback this week. First up is Facunda, who says, I love your podcast and Fargo. I want to talk about the Mark, help me out. What's the Mac? It's not a macaroon.
Oh, it's macaron.
Macaron.
Kind of. I'm not going to say it with a French accent. Sorry.
It's an Italian. Okay. Well, we're going to talk about that.
I know it's an Italian thing made. It's made in France by an Italian. Yeah, I know.
I want to talk about the macaron the nurse Mayflower bakes for Dr. Harvard, because I thought found it to be a great metaphor. His favorite dish was actually invented by an Italian chef for Queen Catherine. It's mistakenly credited as a French delicacy when it's actually invented by an Italian, the same group that was barred from entering his pristine hospital. I don't think we actually talked about that.
Oh, that's true. Yeah,
he hates Italians, but they they gave birth to his favorite dessert that he mispronounces. So, strychnine, the poison used by Nurse Mayflower, also has an almond flavoring.
Okay,
would probably make a dessert delicious.
I could have sworn we talked about this stuff last episode, but
Didn't think, because I didn't get the exact poison, but yeah, strychnine, yeah, it does have that flavoring and probably would, you know, be delicious. They close with, the show is incredible. The storyline so timely and the dialogue speaks volumes to race in America and Americans' origin story and its treatment of immigrants. I agree. Thanks for that. Moving on to Tom from Maryland. I wanted to weigh in on the Josto casting controversy. Contrary to those who don't like Jason Schwartzman cast as Josto, I think he is perfectly cast for that part. He got the part because he fits the character. Schwartzman's not great looking. Is that true? I think he's on the upper end of average.
I mean, anybody in Hollywood is on the upper end of average, but Schwartzman is on the lower end of Hollywood. Let's say that.
I think I've seen him hot a couple times.
I mean, he's no Paul Giamatti, but you know.
Wow. Shots fired at Paul Giamatti. He has a weak chin. He's not physically imposing. Plus, his voice is not necessarily imposing either. God damn, Jason Schwartzman, do not download this podcast. I'm trying to protect you. Even when he holds a gun, doesn't really seem threatening. All these qualities are perfect for Josto. I see him as someone who has had to fight the weakling label since birth. He's probably a skinny, unattractive kid who stayed mostly in the shadows.
Are we still talking about Schwartzman?
No, we moved on to Josto, but just continue to be... He's dead already! Stop the beating! My God! As such, he didn't command a lot of respect until he grew into adulthood. Even up until the time of the show, he's still in his father's shadow. Then his dad dies, and boom, he's the boss. All these hardened criminals who have followed Il Padre for years, and now the weakling's in charge. Note the not-so-subtle asides and challenges to his authority in early episodes. Again, the Gaetano shows up and openly defies him. He's been trying to shed the weakling label his entire life, and now he's openly challenged by his brother. My prediction is that Josto will make a decision or do something out of motivation that will lead to his downfall. Insecurity leads people to do some stupid things. Probably a safe bet. None of the men depicted as the heads of these crime families, with the possible exception of Loy, have been shown as paragons of virtue or cunning or strength.
True.
So that's a pretty good bet that his insecurity is going to cause him to do something crazy.
I feel like he's already done that. Like, telling Loy to kill Gaetano was essentially that. It just worked out accidentally in his favor.
Yeah, it acts. Yeah, it's because his brother is as a dumb as a screwball as he is. So he did the opposite day routine and decided to swear allegiance to his brother.
Sure.
Paul. So that takes care of one side of Fada. Paul's going to shore up the other side. He says, you guys seem very frustrated by Gaetano's first scene in Camp Elegance, but I can help. The reason he shits the bed, as you say, is not that he's not used to calling hits. He's rather used to performing them. He most likely hasn't considered the repercussions of ordering the death of Dr. Senator. And as the episode description even states, he must pay the piper. He's realizing he's not the boss. I'd also assume he's completely day drunk in this episode, like he usually is at the compound. Oh, yeah. I don't know that we've ever seen a sober Gaetano. He's stabbing mannequins, and Paolo is sipping a drink on the sofa. A supplemental explanation, considering his most recent coming to terms with his role in a family, is that Gaetano's history is part of Mussolini's death squad, either real, exaggerated, or not, gives him a particular form of PTSD, and that he's nervous before a fight because he's not a planner. But if he's thrust into a situation, such as fending off Mort Kellerman's goons with high-powered pistols, his eyes go wide and he seems right at home. I understand the incompetence in episode 6 seemed like a huge character reveal at the time, and it's crucial, but not as consistent or inconsistent when you put it in the context, because the bull is only strong when he's already on the charge. Interesting. I guess that tracks, that you can cow a bull into like going off in the slaughter pretty meekly, but like, you know, you openly defy him in a pasture and he's going to gore you. I guess that tracks.
I don't know. I've never raised
bulls. A lot of animal husbandry based metaphor you got to lean on to make that work out. But I still think, okay, like I said, I can squint and see this stuff. I really can. Mm-hmm. It's just, I feel like it's maybe a flaw of characterization, casting, or direction, or all three, that we got to really filter what we're seeing here through a whole bunch of like, oh, well, he did say, you know what I mean? Like, I find that to be true anyway, that if you're zigging and zagging and the audience doesn't follow it with you, then either it's the problem with the audience.
I have a tendency think I'm just a dummy who can't follow the clear tracks of the show's laying.
On the other hand, millions of people are watching this, like, you know, and discussing it. Like, I don't think they're all dumb. Yeah, you and me, we're idiots, but right. Like, there's right. Millions of smart people watching this show. They gotta be getting stuff. Maybe Paul's one of them.
Could be.
I just feel like I took a stealth shot at Paul. Didn't intend to do that. Paul's certainly one of those millions of smart people watching the show. Charles R. has a ring theory. Ready for a ring theory? We've been talking about Ethel Rita's ring.
Okay.
Her mob boss ring. What's going on with it? He says, I would be absolutely shocked if Ethel Rita's life is not saved by Josto seeing her with the ring right before he kills her. Then he does not kill her and instead asks her where she got the ring, why it's from the nurse across the street, the nurse that chokes you during sex, you know, Nurse Mayflower, which will close that loop. That's it. That's actually really interesting.
Why would Josto be killing Ethel Rita? I can't imagine a scenario Loy's group just moved into the mortuary, right?
Right.
So maybe they're doing a hit there. Yep. You know, like the slaughterhouse, payback for the slaughterhouse, right?
Yep. And he's going, he's after most of the action, he's sweeping room to room. He goes to Ethel Rita's upstairs. She's cowering in the corner, holds up her hand. Mm-hmm. I can see it, and it would definitely connect the dots, but then you'd have to go with the whole, did Josto actually order the hit on his dad, or was it miscommunication? Guess what? The next email connects neatly to this concept. Ephraim writes in from Fresno, California. I think Josto didn't mean for Oretta to kill his father. Full Moon by Eden Abbez was playing just as Josto asks Orietta to take care of his dad. The song was also used in season 1, The Rooster Prince, when Mr. Wrench and Numbers was drowning a guy in the lake ice. You remember that? Them sliding that dude in head first and like, woof, that's chilling.
Yeah.
Okay. I think it's intentional to mirror that inciting misreckonings between the two seasons, Josto and Orietta to Lester and Malvo. Could be. I didn't make that musical connection. I think it was, regardless of which interpretation is right, I will go down swinging that scene is designed to be interpreted both ways, or to have a question about whether he actually asked her, whether she was going to do it anyway and decided why not. And I feel like the way that relationship has played out since has kind of buttressed that view. Like, there's nothing I've seen that disproves it.
No, I definitely don't think he was asking for her to kill his father, but I also think it was very ambiguous. And I think they played it, you know, like you said, it was designed to be ambiguous, but they might have been just doing that for fun, or they might have been doing it intentionally, because the fun part there is like, oh, wouldn't it be fun if this gangster uses his coded language accidentally, and people pick up on that when he didn't intend it and go do something consequential. Yeah. I don't know.
Okay.
That's fun.
Yeah, no, I like it. He also has another musical side note. Monin by Lambert Hendricks and Ross is played by the jazz band to open episode 5, which is also used in season 3, The Law of Vacant Places, during Ray's urine test montage. I love Fargo's use of music.
I swear we talked about this too, but okay.
Did we? Maybe. Oh, okay.
Maybe I just had it in my notes and forgot to talk about it.
It could be because it was news to me, but
okay.
Thanks for that, Ephraim.
That's the song that's playing at the jazz club when Lemuel's there, when he's not supposed to be, right?
He's not supposed to be. He's getting pinched by the law.
Yeah.
Whitney Owens. Hey, guys, I'm a huge fan of y'all's podcast. Thank you. Currently enjoying the Fargo one. In a new episode today, you mentioned something about a Christmas Story episode of your podcast. I'm not sure if I heard it correctly, but I immediately went and tried to find it and was unsuccessful. I only went back as far as this past December. Oh man, you were so close. You were so close because we did it for last year's Christmas. And I think the best way to find it is to go to baldmove.com/tag/Christmas. Or if you just search, honestly, if you search a Christmas Story Bald Move, it'll be the top result.
I will say, I think you have to be a club subscriber I think you have to be subscribed to the club to get that. So.
It's premium content. A lot of our Christmas celebration stuff is for our club members only, so that might be another reason why. Even if you found that it might not have a podcast attached because you have to be a premium. So, but hey, you know what? Free trial. You can download it. Use your 30-day free trial. Cancel it. Screw us over.
Or keep it for the Christmas stuff that's coming up. You know, like we're about to do it all again. So.
A big Christmas extravaganza. Keep up with all that at christmas.baldmove.com. Texas Sandman with some Yertle to Turtle business. It goes, afternoon, gents. Let's get straight to this turtle stuff. I'm not sure if you are familiar with this turtle story that Fada Man was telling to Omi at the beginning of the episode, but it was a straight-up retelling of the Dr. Seuss classic Yertle to Turtle. If you're not familiar with the story, Yertle, as the king of turtles, lusts for more power. So he makes more and more of his turtle subjects form a stack for Yertle to stand on the top so he can rule all that he sees. Eventually, the turtle at the bottom, Mac, after asking many times for relief from the crush, burps and ups in his stack. Yertle is plunged in mud and rules no longer. I think the story fits well into the narrative and applies itself well to the current social and political times, with those on top crushing and exploiting the ones below to hold everything together. This reference also coupled well with the brief radio broadcast of Rabbi's Car of McCarthy's speech referencing a list of 205 communist names as the country was famously going through a red scare. One error in the part of production, Yertle the Turtle and Other Stories, the book containing this turtle-y tale, was not published until 1958. I'm pretty sure the season takes place in 1950. Not a big deal, since I think the use of the story is good. Just a little factoid for your next game at Dr. Seuss Trivia. I also, is it not possible that, this is a some kind of Aesop's fable kind of, rhetorical device that then Dr. Seuss turned into a story that became famous? I don't know. Because he didn't say his Yertle. He just said as a king turtle. So, Also not sure if this is a dig at our soon-to-be former Vice President Mike Pence, but the Reverend Roanoke staying at the boarding house corrects whoever labels his female companion as wife with mother. As he made a Pence allegedly refers to his wife as mother. Oh, it's not allegedly. He does it in public, man. I don't know. That could be. Because this show does drive-bys just occasionally on all kinds of different topics. So, but thanks for the Yertle lore. Travis wraps things up by saying this is one of my favorites of the season, and that dinner scene might well be one of the most Coen Brothers scenes ever filmed for this television show. But the episode exposed the biggest flaw of the season as well. I like these characters, but there's so many of them. I wanted more time with Rabbi Milligan and others. I think some of the structure and pacing issues season 4 had has come from this dilemma as well. I don't know what to say about this because there are a lot of characters, but so many of the characters are just people with names and one attributes. What do we really know about Omi? He was a boxer, probably got hurt. Because somebody didn't throw in the towel, and let this black man get his eye beat in. Who was the guy that got shot by Gaetano? I forget his name.
Antoon? No, not shot by Gaetano.
So, Antoon, there's a character that we actually got some kind of backstory to. But it was in the last 5 minutes of his scene. I just feel there's a lot, but big cast suit shows like Game of Thrones, where you're going to be there for 8 seasons and have a bunch of intrigue and a lot of people are going to die, so you need to start planting the seeds. It is an open question about how a large cast helps with an anthology like this, because there's a lot of people, a lot of faces. On the other hand, a lot of them aren't important. Like, if this is Loy's, if this is the Cannon Fodda story, then really, you know, Loy's immediate family, his sons, maybe his top lieutenant, Dr. Senator. Yeah. Those are the important people. Everybody else is like, not. And then to take a whole season, to take a whole episode to concentrate on two characters that you're probably going to write out at the end of it. It's a weird way to tell a story.
Who's the guy that keeps saying he's smart, he's got brains, and he wants to move up in Cannon's organization? Yeah, unless they do something more with him in these last two episodes, completely wasted time with Leon. Like, I don't know why we saw any of that.
I can see him shitting the bed on the way up. I mean, that's shitting his way to the... I don't know. That's almost worth it just for that line of dialogue. But,
yeah. Well, I don't know. We'll see. I think you're right, though. The anthology, especially like a short, you know, minimized number of episodes, I guess, has one longer than a lot of TV shows are nowadays, but that's not a lot of time to do that much with so many characters.
Yeah, and that's the thing about, like, if this season is kind of morality play, it's not of critical importance that a morality play entertains you. It's trying to inform you or make you think about something, to instill upon you a principle or a moral lesson. So, like, you know, Aesop's fables are not like head, you know, sit on the edge of your seat thrillers. Like, oh, is the fox going to get these grapes? Oh, he's not, and he's just going to say they're sour. Mm-hmm. That's because he's full. He just doesn't care about these sour grapes. Like, you know, so much of this story feels like it's telling us something about America and what it means to be an American and what it means to be an immigrant. If it's entertaining is almost like a secondary point. Obviously it should be, because if a morality tale's entertaining, it's going to be more effective. But
sure.
I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what the, because I honestly have no idea. Like, I'm not like, I, my vested interest is to see Loy Cannon succeed because I like his outfit better. They seem smarter. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this season's also told me that that doesn't matter. Like, your individual guile and intelligence and smarts only count for so much in America. Mm-hmm. So it could be that despite being a complete idiot and unimpressive in every way, that the Cannon, the Fodda boys are going to win with their political connections and their extra financial support they get from New York and the old country, and the resources that they have that Loy's group just doesn't have, which would be America as fuck. All right. Fargo@baldmove.com is where you give us your in-depth Fargo takes, hopefully involving bluebirds, rainbows, tornadoes, dogs and picnic baskets, and melting witches. We need to bring all those together in the next 2 weeks, or what have we even been doing this for? Fargo@baldmove.com or on our forums, forums.baldmove.com. We'll be back next week to see how this thing wraps up in Technicolor with the penultimate episode. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.